The impact on biodiversity will absolutely affect human life because we are a part of that biodiversity. I think we're inextricably linked to what happens to biodiversity and impacts on biodiversity.
Welcome to No Planet B, a podcast where we're talking about, you guessed it, climate change and its effects on planet A. I'm Wyatt.
I'm Bree. This week, we have a really awesome topic about biodiversity and how it's going to be affected by climate change with one of our previous professors, Dr. Pau. She's a badass.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it's true. You heard it.
Yeah, so we ended up talking about biodiversity and sort of how climate change is going to affect it, which included a lot of discussion about bananas. And a lot of discussion about instant coffee.
Instant coffee is disgusting.
Instant coffee is...
I knew I hated it for a reason. That's all I'm going to say.
That's all that needs to be said. Yeah, this was a lovely interview. And we hope you all enjoy it. So I'm going to drop it right here in front of you for you to hear. And it'll be here in 1 second. Right now. All right.
You want to start off with telling us what you do? And
I basically study, I guess in the broadest terms, biodiversity and ecosystem functions. And I generally focus on forest and savanna type systems. So, for example, I've been doing research in Panama and in Hawaii for several years now, and more recently, I've been working in some grasslands and in the longleaf pine savannas here in Florida. Like I was talking to you guys about earlier, though, I guess I shouldn't, as I'm saying that, I guess I shouldn't reference earlier stuff.
No, that's perfectly fine.
I generally use remote sensing methods to understand broad scale changes in biodiversity and ecosystem function. So when I say remote sensing, traditionally that refers to using Earth observing satellites. So we have all these satellites that are orbiting and basically taking measurements of the Earth continuously. But more recently, that's also referred to what we call near surface remote sensing. So things like drones and even mounted cameras and those sorts of technologies.
So what we wanted to be able to get into in the bigger picture of this episode is basically what is biodiversity and how is climate change affecting it? And so those are some pretty broad questions, and we wanted to dive in starting with just what is biodiversity?
Yeah, so biodiversity we can think of as the diversity within species, between species, and of ecosystems. And so I think that the term biodiversity, or when we think about impacts on biodiversity, it can be a little bit abstract because it's, kind of just an aggregate sort of measure of these different kinds of diversity. But I guess more specifically, we can think of when we say genetic diversity, even within one species. So if you think of dogs, dogs are all one species, but they show tremendous variation in different traits, so like colors, behavior, size, etc. Okay, so within one species, you can have enormous genetic diversity. That also counts as biodiversity. The most common measure of biodiversity is probably what we call species richness, and that's just the number of different species. And then lastly, we can think of diversity across ecosystems. So the diversity of different ecosystems we have, like wetlands versus forests versus grasslands, for example. So I'd say that in a nutshell is biodiversity. But it's really just the diversity of life on Earth. It's like any kind of measure of the diversity of life.
What aspects of climate change are affecting biodiversity the most?
So the aspects of climate change that are affecting biodiversity the most... The reason why I'm hesitating a little bit is because what I can say is that warming temperatures, so increasing temperatures that's associated with increases in greenhouse gases, you know, so the greenhouse effect, it's probably the most consistent and widespread impact on species and ecological communities across the whole globe. And that's partly because that's one of the, you know, I guess most prevalent effects of climate change. Whereas if you think about how climate change is impacting differences in rainfall, it's really region specific. So some places are getting warmer, some places are getting wetter, some are getting drier, and some aren't changing very much at all. So when you think about how climate change is affecting biodiversity, one part of that answer is how much and what aspects of the climate are actually changing.
Okay, cool. So basically, like, the answer is it's complicated because climate change isn't just going to have one effect on all of Earth, but maybe the most consistent of those effects is going to be temperature across the globe.
Yep. Yeah, perfect.
I think that's where a lot of confusion comes in with people who aren't super into science or
That's when you have, you know, senators throwing snowballs on Capitol Hill, you know, saying that climate change isn't real because they're having, you know, record snow events during a particular winter. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I totally agree, Brianna. It's, I guess there's some confusion just because of these differential effects, but there, you know, there is a consistent, there are consistent patterns that are emerging. It just takes kind of stepping back and looking at the long-term changes.
Would you say that these are intense effects right now happening due to climate change?
Yes. There was one of the things I was excited to talk to you guys about and why I think this is a great topic is that there was a recent report that came out by the UN. I don't know if you guys or your listeners have heard of it, but it's has this funny acronym, which I just realized that I was pronouncing wrong for a while, but it's the IPBES report. So they need a better acronym. But the IPBES report, or at least a summary for policymakers, was just released, a few months ago, but just in the last year by the UN. And they synthesized, similar to the IPCC for climate change, their job was to synthesize the existing literature on how biodiversity is changing. And so what they found, and again, they're not conducting their own science, they're synthesizing existing science done by independent scientists, you know, from several different countries. And they found that biodiversity is declining faster than at any other time in human history. And they estimated that 1 million species are threatened. And so it is the first time that we've had like a nice global estimate like that. And so to have that number, 1 million threatened species, and knowing that, you know, the drivers of biodiversity loss are accelerating and that the loss that's occurring is happening faster than ever in human history, I think is something for, you know, policymakers and then just people like, you know, concerned citizens to, take note of. That sounds not urgent enough, but having that number, I think, definitely makes the issue much more urgent. So yeah, those are some stats that kind of summarize the impact of biodiversity loss. Yeah, so pretty intense, the impact right now. And I think the main message is that it's just getting worse and worse.
I have a question about some words that came up when I was Googling this, or if I was reading a report or something. They would refer to this as the sixth mass extinction.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So there have been at least 5 mass extinctions in the geologic record. And you know what? After I give my spiel, whatever that is, I'm not sure what I'm going to say yet. I'm gonna look up this really great podcast I listened to and send it to you guys, because there's a professor at UCLA who was on. There's a guy. What is that show? Oh, okay, I'll look it up afterwards. There was a really great podcast I listened to, and she studies evolution and extinction. And so she explained it really well. But basically, there have been 5 mass extinctions in the geologic record. And that means, you know, through the past like hundreds of millions of years, like really long timescales, we can see in the geologic record these punctuated events. So species losses are constantly happening throughout the geologic record, right? Yeah. Species evolve and they go extinct. That's just how life happens and how evolution happens. But if you look in the geologic record, there are these punctuated moments in history where a ton of species just went extinct. I think the one sort of metric for defining a mass extinction is 75% of species in most of taxonomic groups went extinct. So...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that's happened five times in the past, and it's been associated with really dramatic environmental change that's happened on Earth. So one of the most famous ones is the asteroid, you know, slamming into the Earth, and that led to the dinosaurs basically going extinct. So that's one of the most famous ones. Huge, large groups of animals went extinct. So are we in the sixth mass extinction? I guess to answer that, we kind of need, again, like the long-term perspective, right? So somebody, I saw somebody tweet, I think a friend of mine joked that, you know, if you, 100 million years from now, if you look in the geologic record of the Anthropocene, like where we are right now, you just see this like thick layer of plastic, which is funny and sad at how accurate it probably is. I mean, absolutely, the changes that are happening on Earth right now are unprecedented. The most recent study I've seen is, I can't quote a date for you, but it's not super recent. And what that study found, it's by Anthony Baranowski. He's at UC Berkeley. It might have even been done like 10 years ago, so not super recent. But he did a systematic study of whether we're currently in the sixth mass extinction. And he found that we haven't quite met that 75% threshold, but we're getting we're getting there. And we're really close for some groups. Amphibians were super close to that 75% threshold. But, you know, there are different estimates out there. So there are, I'd say it's an active area of research, and definitely some scientists think that we have met that mark. I think the kind of take home is that, like, these mass extinctions are so drastic, and we're close enough where we're arguing about whether we're there or not. So we're like, whether we're going to define it as the sixth mass extinction based on like different people's definitions, I think is not the point. The point is, like, we're already so close to completely these really devastating events that have happened on Earth and completely changed the trajectory of Earth and nature that, like, yeah, it's bad, right?
Yeah. Goodness. Yeah, the 75% is a bizarre number to hear.
Yeah, I think it just comes down to how do you define a mass extinction? And so you have to define it using some, you know, like objective number, right?
And I wish we didn't have to define it.
What's that?
I wish we didn't have to define it.
Yeah, that's kind of why my answer is sort of like, you know, whatever your definition is, it's bad. We know that. Scientists can agree on that.
You mentioned earlier a report that synthesized a lot of data already about biodiversity.
Yeah, so you already forgot the acronym because it's such a forgettable one. Yeah, the IPBES report.
I didn't think I'd be called out like that. Yeah, so how active is the field of like predicting biodiversity in response to climate change?
It's really active. Lots of scientists working on different aspects of that. So if you think about the different kinds of biodiversity, so genetic diversity, species diversity, ecological diversity. There are lots of scientists studying all those different kinds of aspects of biodiversity. And then we also talked about the different drivers of climate change. So lots of people studying different aspects of climate change too, the impact of warming temperatures, the impact of extreme events, you know, the impact of sea level rise on biodiversity. So it's a super, super active field and almost so large that the reason why this report was needed is because they were able to summarize all of those hundreds and hundreds of studies looking at these different aspects of biodiversity and different aspects of climate change and kind of summarize all that information for us.
Wyatt had found this interesting article talking about your research. Discussing the increased carbon dioxide making more flowers bloom. Would you say that there's any potential benefits of climate change to biodiversity in that sense, or?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So first of all, I looked at that article first, and I was like, oh, cool. Like, my research got press, you know? And then just before, I'm like, great, people are interested in my research. It's getting out there. Just before our Skype, I like scrolled down to the comments, and I was like, oh, my.
Yeah. Was this the first time you'd seen it?
Yes, that article.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm like, I welcome the opportunity to talk about the more nuanced issue in that paper. So,
yeah.
First of all, such a good question. Like, are there any benefits to climate change? So absolutely. Like, with climate change, there will be winners and there'll be losers of climate change. Okay, so I don't think there is a scientist or an ecologist out there who would argue with that, right? Mm-hmm. I think the key question or the key issue is that is that we depend on these species and these ecosystems and on biodiversity. So there might be winners and there might be losers, but those winners will result in, or that change will result in, a very, very different Earth than we depend on right now. If we just think about climate change, the Earth has experienced, it's been warmer than it is currently. Okay, so scientists are not trying to say that this is, that the Earth can't handle warmer temperatures. It's definitely been warmer, but humans were not living on Earth at that time. It was an inhospitable Earth to us. So it's not a question about just, you know, this question about like good or bad in terms of climate change really has to do with our existence and our dependence on the Earth. It's not like some inherent good or bad for the Earth. It's about what we depend on. So the way I look at it is, we know that climate change is going to drastically affect species, communities, and ecosystems. And like I said, these are the ones that we depend on for things like what we call ecosystem services, but we can think of them as pollinating our crops, filtering our water, cycling nutrients, storing carbon and keeping it at a hospitable temperature. There's a gazillion different things that we depend on nature for. And there's also things that I'm sure are happening that we haven't even identified or quantified. Will climate change benefit some species? Probably, yes. But will that still be a drastic change to Earth? Yeah. And I think that mm-hmm. that uncertainty is, should worry us, that uncertainty. So my paper is a really good example to talk about this. We basically showed in one of the longest flowering records in the tropics, it looks like, so just to back up, what I think is super fascinating is over the last 30 years or so, there's this tropical forest in Panama, and it has been producing more and more flowers each year. So that's just like this beautiful image, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we showed that it does seem to be linked to increasing atmospheric CO2. It sounds like a good thing. It sounds like a benefit of climate change, right? And I just have to say that the goal of the paper wasn't to address at all whether this is good or bad for us or for plants. I think that, you know, most scientific studies, in fact, I should probably say all scientific studies, can't answer good or bad. That's like a completely different set of questions that people have to answer for themselves, the good or bad part, the like ethics of it, right? So we set out to answer really just ecological questions about how global change is affecting flowering, or we could think of it as reproductive activity. How is it affecting tropical reproductive activity? What I guess the implications, though, of course people want to know, is this good or bad? And a lot of the comments were, gosh, what were some of them?
It's rough.
Well, you know what's frustrating is they get super personal, and it's like, okay, people.
Yeah.
Really dramatic.
Yeah. I mean, I think that some of their points are totally valid, but I think that there's just some nuance. So do we know that CO2 is good for plants? Yeah, they're right. Some of these commenters are correct. CO2, we can think of as food for plants. We know that, more CO2 can result in faster plant growth, okay? What we haven't shown before So the comments that were like, duh, who is this scientist? I can't believe she has a PhD or whatever. What they don't know is that there's far less evidence looking at how CO2 has affected reproductive activity. So in this case, flowering. There's also far less evidence in tropical forests, and there's far less evidence using observational data. So most of the data, or most of the, you know, studies they're referring to are probably experimental studies. And those experimental studies will like pump really high amounts of CO2 into a chamber and see how a plant responds. Those studies usually increase CO2 super, super high to like 600 or 800 parts per million. So I think what was really important about our study is we're showing, hey, this is already happening. Climate change is already affecting tropical forests. Okay, we're not increasing CO2 experimentally in some like artificial chamber. It's like a real forest that is being impacted by climate change. So secondly, I had said something about how far fewer studies have looked at how CO2 affects reproductive output. The studies that have looked at reproductive output, what they have shown, and this is going to go back to your question about what this is, if this is good or bad, what they have shown is that, and these are in completely different systems, so it hasn't been shown in the tropics. We need to do those. We need more studies like this. But in some conifers, they've shown that it increases reproductive activity. In this case, it would be like the production of cones, not flowers. And that's because these plants are reaching reproductive age sooner. So they produce more cones, which are the equivalent of flowers for flowering plants. But they're also dying younger. They're cycling through their life cycle much faster.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I wish I could say that more. I feel like the impact wasn't there. But but yeah, so they're growing faster because of more CO2, reaching reproductive age more quickly. Reproducing cones and, you know, maybe flowers more quickly, producing more, but then dying much younger than plants that hadn't received elevated CO2. So the question about whether it's good or bad is just like, well, we don't know. So in this paper, it wasn't my job to say that this flowering was good or bad. But if you were to ask me, so thank you for having me on and asking me, I would say we don't know. I'm not going to say it's good or bad, but the evidence that's out there is suggesting that it's bad.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I'm glad you're able to talk about it because that's definitely more nuanced than a lot of people seem to have interpreted as.
Yeah, and they didn't read the paper. It's in the paper. Yeah, I don't know what to think about comments. I don't know. They're so... it's like we're having completely different conversations. You know, I'm speaking to a group of scientists that kind of know the literature already and...
Exactly.
You know, kind of understand the nuance. I think it would have been very different if I were writing something for the public.
Absolutely. Yeah. These are people that kind of, I guess, lack a lot of context, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so important, though. I mean, it makes me feel like how can it does really affect me. I feel, you know, I feel bad that it's being that scientific research is being misinterpreted. And so that's why I wanted to do this podcast. Like, how can I, as a scientist, do a better job at communicating the impacts of climate change?
Yeah. Well, that's the overall goal here is we want to, I don't know, kind of normalize science communication a little bit more and give everyone a voice, you know?
Yeah. I guess what I wonder, though, is do you think we actually need... Do we need more science? Do we need more research? Do we just need scientists talking in like normal, using normal words, not referring to IPBES.
A little bit. There's a paper Brianna and I were talking about earlier that's like they did a survey of people and they found that people tend to trust more face-to-face individuals than they do researchers. And I think this was specifically in medical fields. So like they would trust a doctor telling them something over a research paper that they would read about medical information or something. Like right now, when we're talking about like science communicators, we have like some that are well known and that people kind of love or love to hate. But we kind of want to make that, who am I talking to about science? We want to make that circle more expansive so that people have more people to talk to about science. And so when you have a face to it and when you have and when it's an approachable idea, people tend to believe it more and tend to like want to talk about it more.
Yeah.
Would you be able to give some examples of how protecting biodiversity would impact human life?
Absolutely. I guess I want to back up and say that I think we have to stop thinking about the impact on biodiversity as separate than us. So the impact on biodiversity will absolutely affect human life because we are a part of that biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
We're a part of the food chain. You know, we're just as a part of nature as, you know, the ivory-billed woodpecker or something like that. So I think we're inextricably linked to what happens to biodiversity and impacts on biodiversity. The ways that we are linked would be things like, I guess, our food systems. So not just pollinating our crops, which, you know, I've mentioned before, but also just the genetic diversity that underlies our food system. So with climate change, we're going to need our crops to be resilient to all kinds of different changing environmental conditions they're going to experience, whether it's warming temperatures or increasing droughts or whatever it may be. Okay. Our domesticated crops, the resilience of those domesticated crops are going to rely on genetic diversity in their wild relatives. So that genetic diversity and biodiversity, which again, I've said is like a little bit of an abstract concept, it really underlies so many things that we depend on, that genetic diversity. It is what is going to allow us to be resilient to changing conditions. So I think food systems and our crops that we depend on are one of the most direct and tightest links between biodiversity and human well-being. But there are other ones too. For example, I guess filtering our water, recycling nutrients, storing carbon, things like that.
Are food systems going to be affected in the way of monocultures becoming less and less viable?
Yeah, absolutely. Monocultures are really vulnerable to any kind of environmental change. So, for example, if some pest or pathogen affects a crop, if it's a monoculture, it'll just wipe out that entire field, right?
That's right, yeah.
That's why it's important to have, to sort of rotate your crops and to kind of have, I'm not using the right term, but like mixed crops. There's a term for that. Sorry.
Polyculture?
Yeah. Polyculture, I guess, is one term. So yeah, monocultures are really vulnerable to any kind of environmental change just because they're not as resilient. So, you know, even we do have a lot of monocultures out there. Even if you're not practicing like polyculture or rotating crops, we still, even with monoculture, we still have to protect the wild relatives of those species, though, because that's where the genetic diversity that will allow them to be resilient to pest pathogens, you know, droughts, etc. That's where that capability lies. So we still have to think about everything connected is like such a cliche, but we still have to think about, you know, those agricultural systems as really dependent on natural wild systems as well.
Yeah. We interviewed a coffee grower, Felipe, and you mentioned that one of the best ways to adapt for a farm to adapt to climate change is by promoting biodiversity. So like certain farmers, instead of just growing a specific coffee bean, they would also start growing cocoa or like cardamom to like kind of promote diversity.
Yeah, that's so cool to hear. I'll be interested in listening to your interview with him. I think that's really true, and I'm glad to hear that they're practicing those. So there's sort of like two ways to think about it. One is that, you know, when you are practicing something like agroforestry, for example, with coffee, where you have sort of like intermittent fruit trees between your crops, it's not just like a big field of only coffee, but you have other species and crops mixed in. So one, those kinds of food systems will be less vulnerable to pests and pathogens and other stressors in the first place. And then secondly, I had mentioned that, you know, we still need the wild relatives of these domesticated crops for their genetic diversity. So there's sort of two reasons why maintaining biodiversity is so important to our food systems.
Why exactly does having the genetic relatives help?
There's a good example right now. Almost all the bananas, you know, when you go to the store.
Awesome. I was just thinking about bananas.
The Cavendish bananas. Yeah, we're just like about such this. Nerds that we're really excited to talk about the Cavendish bananas.
Yeah.
Okay, it's fine.
So almost all the bananas that we get in the supermarket are one kind, one variety of banana. And I'm saying almost all because, you know, sometimes you see like the little tiny plantains. But if you've ever had them, they are not as sweet. They're more starchy. So most people, when they're just like eating bananas as a snack or on their cereal, they're getting these Cavendish bananas. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's one variety that like pretty much everybody on earth eats. And well, I shouldn't say that. There are, you know, there are maybe in the U.S. I'll say. That we eat. Yeah. So there's a fungus, I believe, or some pest or pathogen that is wiping out these Cavendish bananas. And because we depend on just this one variety, you know, they're being wiped out everywhere, right? So if we have wild relatives, we could crossbreed crops that are vulnerable with wild relatives that might have the genetic capacity to be, in this case, I'm sort of just hypothetically speaking with these bananas, but in this case, maybe there's some wild relative that has the genes that are, that can tolerate this fungus or that has some resistance to it, right?
Yeah.
And so.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And so that's why we need those wild relatives.
This is another one we talked about in the coffee episode where like most coffee production deals with Arabica and that plant's like a lot more sensitive to like temperature and all these and like pests and stuff. So what people have started doing is breeding that with Robusta, I guess, and creating like these new breeds that are going to be similar to Arabica in some ways, but they're going to be more resilient like Robusta in other ways. And I think that's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, we are going to depend on these plant breeding techniques, you know, in the future. I think though, so that's all super cool. Arabica tends to grow in these higher elevations and they're more sensitive to warming temperatures. They generally are, the yield is not as high. So things like, you know, a lot of the instant coffee is all Robusta coffee and they're grown in like low elevations. That type of coffee contributes to tropical deforestation more than Arabica because Arabica tends to grow in higher elevations, not like these large expanses of lowland forests. But
really?
Yeah. But, you know, what I was going to say before I got on this tangent is that we also need to. So, yeah, we need plant breeding strategies to like get us out of this mess that we're creating. But I also think, you know, we kind of just need to. I shouldn't say kind of. We have to slow climate change and the loss of biodiversity to begin with. Otherwise, we're just kind of playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that deforestation, bad farming practices, and pollution are contributing or more threatening than climate changes? Or would you say that climate change is a bigger problem right now?
Well, if we focus on biodiversity, deforestation, well, actually, it's changes in land use is a bigger impact on biodiversity than climate change right now. And most of that is actually deforestation in tropical areas because tropical forests are one of the most diverse biomes on Earth. The other is, we usually say land use change, but also increasingly what we'll call sea use change. So coral reefs are also super, super diverse, and they're being impacted because of sea use change. So this came out of that IPBES report where they ranked different drivers of biodiversity. So changes in land use and sea use came up first. Direct exploitation was second. So that would be like fishing and fishing and hunting, that sort of thing. And then third was climate change.
Interesting.
Yeah, so climate change ranked third. Then after that was pollution, and then the last was invasive or alien species.
Interesting.
So as far as what is worse for just like human well-being, I think they're both just linked. So it would be hard to say, is the loss of biodiversity worse than climate change or you're asking about land use. I'd say it's all linked.
What exactly is land use change?
Deforestation is one example, but any urbanization, like paving, like building a mall over a wetland, and that's happening a lot in Florida, like literally building malls over wetlands.
Oh my God.
What are other examples? Anything where you're changing the land cover to something different would be land use change.
Yeah, because I know that's like usually what people list as like the number one contributor to that, to like threats to biodiversity.
Yeah, it's happening. I mean, if you look at the statistics in tropical forests, it's happening so fast. Like as we speak, they're just being torn down. A lot of it's burning, and a lot of it's oil palm right now. Look at the food you eat, like Clif Bars, or even, I guess, in makeup, like lipstick and stuff, although I've never seen ingredients for that. But palm oil or oil palm is in everything. And that is definitely contributing to deforestation. Yeah. So sometimes you'll see organic palm oil. And I think that theoretically that could still cause deforestation. It just means they're not, you know, using pesticides on it. So I'm not sure if organic's any better. But palm oil is just universally bad.
So that is one thing that we can say is bad.
Yeah, I've been trying to be careful about saying, yes, palm oil is bad.
So in reading a lot about how biodiversity is going to adapt to climate change, people talk a lot about like three different kind of directions. And it's through spatial, temporal, and physiological.
I feel like that's straight out of my lecture in class.
It may have been. It may have been. So meaning, and maybe you can explain this or stop me when I've explained it incorrectly, but spatial meaning certain species are physically going to be moving to different places because they're more fit to live there. Temporal meaning they change their certain like life cycles or biological cycles to adapt to things that are more suitable for them.
And physiological being like they actually change when they do certain things, or like when.
Yeah, that's kind of it is tough to think about that. So I think the first thing you explained the first two perfectly, right? So species can physically move to more favorable environments. They can stay in one place and alter their behavior. So for example, a lot of plants in temperate areas, they are flowering earlier in the spring because our winters are getting shorter, our springs are happening earlier, so they're flowering earlier, right? So they're not physically moving, but they're changing their activity through time. The thing that's tough about physiological changes is that these three categories aren't mutually exclusive. So, you know, physiological changes can underpin changes in space or time. But I think the way to think about it on a slightly different axis is, for example, a plant can adapt to just tolerate warmer temperatures or change their resource use efficiency. So that's sort of three ways of thinking about how species will adapt.
Very cool. And which of those do you think is the most common?
That's hard to say. They're not mutually exclusive. So that's part of the reason why it'd be hard to say which is the most common. But the general pattern is that species are moving uphill and poleward. So species are basically, as temperatures warm, they're tracking those warming temperatures, right? As it's getting warmer, they're moving poleward to follow those more favorable climates. And they're moving uphill where, again, following that as temperatures warm, yeah, that band of temperature.
So poleward and uphill are kind of where they'd want to go in order to keep things similar to how they already are?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Are there any big takeaways you'd like to emphasize or any organizations you'd like to mention?
So I've been talking about this ITBES report. I'm sorry, I keep repeating that awful boring acronym, but
that's perfect.
I think the point that I want to make is that when you see a lot of this report came out a few months ago, there is a lot of media coverage. So you saw all the major news organizations covering it. Maybe not Fox. And you know what? I'm like, I'm of course super excited that this came out and that it's getting coverage. And as I'm reading these different, you know, pieces on NPR or whatever it may be, it's kind of boring to me. I'm reading through these statistics, and of course, like, they should convey a sense of urgency. But to some degree, like, hey, we've known that biodiversity loss is occurring for like decades now. Yeah. I've learned this stuff since I was an undergrad, right? And so I read, of all the different newspaper articles I read, the one that kind of stuck out to me was one in The Guardian. And it was a quote from the current chair of IPBES, Ana Maria Hernandez. And I forget exactly what she said, but the crux of what she was saying is that she doesn't necessarily see huge transformative change happening immediately. But what gives her optimism are young people. And I was like, yes. Same with, yeah, I know. You, seriously, I'm like so excited you guys are doing this podcast. I felt like that kind of that kind of is captured exactly how I feel too. So many politicians currently, and just people who run the country and people who run corporations, like, you know, they might be making small changes here and there, but we need dramatic, transformative change. We need it immediately. And the people who I see energized, the people who I see not taking a no for an answer are, you know, people like you guys. And I think about the Parkland kids a lot, too. It's a different issue. But, you know, that took a lot of energy, a lot of determination, a lot of guts to go out there, you know, on the public forum, be activists. And like I said, like, not, don't take no for an answer when people are saying, well, we can't do this because of this. Well, that's unrealistic. You know, we really need transformative change now, and we need the next generation to do it. So I guess the big takeaway is, you know, the way to think about, you know, we got to end with some like call to action, right? So it's great to give people more information, but now that hopefully we've got them motivated and riled up to do something, there's two ways to think about what you can do. You can make personal changes in your life. So you could try to drive less. You can try to avoid palm oil. I mean, what are the things we've talked about, right? There are lots of different things that you can try to do on a personal level. We also need systematic change. We need institutional change. It's we need help from our government, from our politicians, from our policymakers, right? So we need, for example, solar energy to be an option for residences. And that's something Tallahassee is doing, so that's awesome. But there's lots of examples of that. We need better public transportation. We need more electric vehicles. So we need both. We have to think about like the two-prong approach. What are the small personal changes we can make? We could try to fly less, blah, 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 blah. But we also need to vote. And I think that that's one of the most important things that we can do.
Absolutely.
Thank you for saying all that. Yeah, we super agree. We're happy. We sometimes get messages from people younger than us that'll be like, hey, we're doing this like rally, or we're doing this like we're skipping school.
Yeah, do it.
It's so cool hearing all these like people, these young folks just like standing up and doing stuff about the climate. It's so fun to see. They're so energized about it.
Yeah, and it really is motivating for me too, because, you know, I can sit here at my computer and do my scientific studies, but, you know, I'm relying on the public to make their voices heard. Well, I think it's super cool you guys are doing this and continuing the podcast.
Thank you. It's super cool that people like you are taking time to talk to us, you know? Yeah, anything else in terms of...
No, I don't think so. Just, you know, feel free to get in touch if you guys need anything. But thanks again for continuing the podcast and for getting the message out there.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for being on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, best of luck, guys.
Hey, welcome back to...
Well, they didn't leave.
I hope they didn't leave. Please don't leave. Yeah, that was a fun interview, and we hope y'all loved it as much as we did and had as much fun as we did talking about bananas and instant coffee and internet comments. That was a fun turn. That was a pretty fun turn of events.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just really hope you guys take what she said to heart, because it's just really important to try and be involved.
Speaking of being involved, Bree, how can you find No Planet B?
Oh, well, since you asked, we have a Twitter and an Insta. I'm still working on the MySpace. It's fine.
Thank God.
Our Twitter is No Planet B Cast, and our Insta is No Planet B Cast, right? It's not FSU anymore.
Yeah, it's No Planet B Cast.
Yeah. So follow. Yeah, follow. remember when people used to put in their bios, make that follow button green or something? I don't know. Like before the update. Just me. They're like, make that blue button green.
Do people really do that?
I think so. Yeah, bios are so shameless. You know what we should do? We should put our tags on our cars. Let's not do that, but in my head we can do
that. Oh, I would love that.
Like, those obnoxious Insta tags. Wyatt, don't you drive like a lifted truck? Why are you laughing?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought it up. I don't drive a lifted truck. I drive two of them. I have two lifted trucks.
Okay, so plural. He drives two lifted trucks.
Yeah.
One for every other day.
One for work and one for when I'm just kicking it. One for vacation.
Are they hybrids, though? Because we're trying to be sustainable.
They're not hybrids in any way. In fact, it's only diesel.
Wow, that's pretty shameless considering this podcast content.
There's a new kind of oil that's just... there's a new kind of gas that's just diesel mixed with...
Palm oil?
Palm oil. Yeah, and that's it. And so that's just the kind of life I live. You know, I have my bumper stickers all say, like, you know, I'm not in your hurry. And like a picture of my family.
Contrary, I just ride a unicycle everywhere. So.
Wow. So I have what?
So you're chaotic seven evil wheels. And I'm chaotic good.
I have seven wheels over you.
Anyway, be sustainable, bitches.
That sounds like it could be your t-shirt. If we ever made a t-shirt, it would just be your face and they would say that.
With 100% organic cotton. Damn.
Oh, we should make t-shirts, though. Think about it.
Sustainably.
I was thinking about flyers, but we could do a...
How about e-flyers?
That's just what we already do.
I know.
It's just already what we do, you know? Thank you for listening. And we'll see you on the internet. Thanks for listening. Oh, sorry.